when you're making something that is clearly dangerous and clearly can deliver harm, pain, death, there is a responsibility to care about how your gun is sold.
We do have some insane gun laws, and firearms are among the most regulated things in the United States. You can never, ever achieve anything in society by punishing the innocent for the acts of the guilty.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Lawyer to Lawyer, with J. Craig Williams and Robert Ambrosi, bringing you the latest legal news and observations with the leading experts in the legal profession. You're listening to Legal Talk Network.
Hello and welcome to Lawyer on the Legal Talk Network. This is Bob Ambrosi coming to you from just outside of Boston, Massachusetts, where I write a blog called Law Sites and another blog called Media Law. Well, on December 14th, 2012, a lone gunman killed 26 people at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Of those, 20 were first graders. 6 were adults. Some 2 years after that tragedy, the families of the victims have filed a civil suit against Bushmaster Firearms International, the manufacturer of the firearm used in those murders. Today we're going to talk about that case and about the laws at play here, and some of the policy and legal issues and social issues surrounding that lawsuit and those shootings. To help us do that today, we have 3 guests. Let me first begin by welcoming to the show Elliot Feynman. In 2006, a paranoid schizophrenic murdered Mr. Feynman's son with a legally obtained firearm. Since that time, he has gone on to found National Gun Victims Action Council, and he is the president and CEO of that organization, and he's become a leading voice for a network of gun victims, survivors, and the faith community, all seeking to promote what they call saner gun laws in America. Among many other appearances, Mr. Feynman has been on CNBC, CNN, Fox News. He's been quoted by top media outlets, including USA Today, National Public Radio, and the Chicago Sun-Times. And he's hosted a bi-monthly radio program of his own called It's the Guns, Stupid, 1480 WPWC in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Lawyer, Mr. Feynman.
Thank you, Bob. Very happy to be here today.
Well, we're happy to have you. And next, let me welcome to the program Charles Heller. Charles is the former executive director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, and he's now their communications coordinator. He also is a talk show host for shows Swap Shop, Liberty Watch, and America Armed and Free on Radio 1030 KVOI in Tucson, Arizona. He's been a state-certified concealed weapons instructor since 1994. Enlists his political affiliation as Freedomist. Welcome to the show, Charles Heller.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks. And last but not least, let me welcome to the show Nicholas Johnson, who's a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, where his principal subjects are contracts, environmental law, gun control, gun rights. He is the author of the book Negroes and the Gun, The Black Tradition of Arms, and is the lead editor of the book Firearms, Law, and the Second Amendment, Cases and Materials, published by Aspen Press in 2012. He's also published many articles on the Second Amendment and gun control, including a recent article on the Soto versus Bushmaster case titled, Newtown Suit Proceeds Under False Pretenses. Welcome to Lawyer, Nicholas Johnson.
Thank you.
I'd like to just start by going around and getting your reaction to this lawsuit. Be obvious from the descriptions I've just gave of each of you that you're going to have very different reactions to this, but be curious to just get your short take on what you thought when you heard about this lawsuit being filed. And Mr. Feynman, let's start with you.
Well, I certainly understand the reasons why the lawsuit was filed. I work very closely with the people in Newtown since the tragedy. While I live in Chicago, I've spent many trips in Newtown and work very closely with a group called the Newtown Victims and Clergy for Corporate Responsibility. That said, I don't think the suit will be successful. I am sorry that it won't be. But that's because of what I would call the insanity of our gun laws. guns are the only consumer product that are not regulated. It used to be tobacco and guns. Now it's just guns. And because of the immunity that the gun industry enjoys, and because of the way it's structured, I don't believe the suit will be successful. I think it's worthwhile to have filed in terms of the human feeling, you know, that the Newtown parents who've lost children and also lost, you know, sisters and, you know, teachers, you know, the adults, and also to raise, I think it'll be a high profile case, and I think it will raise for the public some of the insanities of our gun laws.
Charles Heller, I'm guessing you'd agree that, in your opinion, this lawsuit might not be successful, but I suspect you have different reasons for thinking that.
It's flawed on its face. The military doesn't use the AR-15, and that's what the case hinges on, and it simply does not. It's just factually incorrect. But we do have some insane gun laws, and firearms are among the most regulated things in the United States. We produce a documentary about it called The Gang, and it shows some of the ways that they just plain evil ways that the BATFE, that some people call Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, we refer to as the brutal and tyrannical fascist extraordinaire, misenforce some of those terrible overregulated laws.
And Nicholas Johnson, I mean, you've made the point in your article that I mentioned at the opening of the show that this lawsuit appears to run contrary to the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, a 2005 law that provides pretty broad immunity to firearms manufacturers.
Well, yeah, my comment was laying out the critique of the complaint based on that law. The law actually allows, you know, traditional lawsuits for negligence. It allows lawsuits against firearms manufacturers if they violate laws that legislators have put in place to govern the purchase and sale and the manufacturing and distribution of firearms. But it does not allow and does prevent these suits based on a variety of different tort theories. And that's a consequence of an earlier spate of lawsuits that were based on a variety of different creative approaches. One was oversupplying firearms, and I guess this one seems to be something like negligent entrustment. And the theory just is not compatible with the existing scheme of firearms regulation. So the AR-15 is allowed under the 1968 Gun Control Act. Other similar sorts of laws also are impacted or have an impact on the assessment here, the National Firearms Act of 1934, and even the Civilian Marksmanship Program, which for a very long time has been the mechanism through which the United States government has provided semi-automatic firearms to individuals under the CMP.
I just want to jump back to Charles Heller. You made the point that this is not a weapon in use in this case. That issue in this case was not a military weapon. Help me understand that. My understanding that this was actually originally designed as a military weapon and that it evolved into other forms of weapons, and I'm no gun expert at all, but Charles, could you explain that to me?
Well, the original design by Eugene Stoner was what became the AR-10, which is a much more powerful gun. It's a .308 caliber weapon. This is the 223 is a very low power as weapons go. It's okay for hunting small deer and good for competition, but the cartridge is not that powerful, number one, the 223 that the military uses. And number two is that the rifle was adapted, a civilian version of it was made, but it's really not the same gun. It's not fully automatic. The military uses almost exclusively full auto and burst fire, whereas the civilian version is semi-auto, and it, just like a revolver, for each pull of the trigger, you get one round out of the chamber. I happen to have one in my lap at the moment, and it's not a particularly fearsome or awesome weapon. It's America's rifle. There's been over 35 million of them made in the last 51 years, and it's America's sport utility rifle. It's probably, after the Ruger 10/22, it's probably the most owned rifle in America. Very common and ordinary. Garden variety.
Nicholas Johnson, you would talk about this a little bit in your article. Does the lawsuit get it right in its description of this weapon or its understanding of this weapon?
No, it really doesn't. And it hinges on an attempt to make an exception or to create an exception to the Prevention of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And what it says is that the U.S. government and the military have taken special efforts to keep the AR-15 out of the hands of civilians. And that's just false. So what I talked about in the blog post was this sort of long history through which we have seen public policymakers for closing in on 100 years making distinctions between fully automatic and semi-automatic firearms. Civilians in the U.S. have had access to semi-automatic firearms since the inception. So you look at guns like the 1907 Winchester, which is nearly 100 years old in design and availability. Things that Charles was describing are basically accurate. So the National Firearms Act of 1934 made, again, a distinction between the regulation of fully automatic and semi-automatic firearms. And access to semi-automatics is fairly wide. One study from a group in Harvard a couple of years ago concluded that 60% of American gun owners own some sort of semi-automatic firearm. So I think just factually that the complaint rests on this attempt to make a distinction between the AR-15 and other types of firearms or other types of semi-automatic firearms. And I don't see a way factually for the plaintiffs to hold that distinction.
Elliot Feynman, your organization is pushing for sane gun laws. Does your organization see a distinction, see that there should be a legal distinction among these types of guns between semi-automatic, fully automatic guns?
Well, we take a different position. The gun side likes to get lost in the details, in the structure, the manufacturing, the size, et cetera, of the guns. And it's because of that when we had the ban on automatic, semi-automatic weapons that it was effectively no ban because it just took the gun manufacturers a little adjustment to the way they made their guns to completely get around it. What we focus on is bullets per minute that can be fired, or bullets that can be fired before reloading. And there's absolutely no defensive reason for having a gun that shoots more than 5 to 10 bullets at a time before needing to be reloaded or per minute. It's so disingenuous to say this is a garden variety tool that people just use for their pleasure of hunting. It's a strictly offensive weapon. It is not a defensive weapon. And it's a weapon that civilians shouldn't have. You never read about somebody having used their semi-automatic weapon to defend themselves or to get out of a difficult situation. What you do read about, of course, is how the semi-automatics are used or the fully automatics are used to commit mass murders. So it's a completely inappropriate gun to be in public hands, and we don't define it in any kind of technical term other than the obvious, which is bullets per minute that can be fired and or bullets that can be fired before reloading.
Can I add something to it's an important point that the other speaker just made, and this is one of the things that I tried to talk about in the blog post and also talked about in Senate testimony. So a couple of things here. One is that if one compares the AR-15, for example, in terms of multi-capability, which was the last comment, to a variety of other common firearms, not only is it not exceptional, but just as a matter of measurement, it's actually inferior to another very common firearm. And I cite to this in the blog post. What I talk about is the common shotgun, which is a multi-projectile kind of technology. And I think, and if people look at this just from the perspective of the arguments and why there's objection on one side or the other, people are making these arguments. The worry, I believe, by people who have a concern about claims that are made about the AR-15 is that there are a variety of other common guns that exceed the AR-15 in terms of multi-shot capability. And that includes most sort of common repeating shotguns loaded with buckshot. And this is not just my assessment. So one of the things that I cite in the blog post is the Army Combat Shotgun Assessment that talks about the effectiveness relative lethality of the AR-15 versus the common repeating shotgun, and finds that the shotgun is superior. So the details do matter here, and for people who just come at this in a neutral way, trying to understand why the different sides take the positions that they do, I think you actually do have to pay attention to the technology and to the distinctions that the pieces of legislation are attempting to make.
I want to come back to this point. And welcome back to Lawyer to Lawyer. This is Bob Ambrogi, and joining me today are Elliot Feynman from the National Gun Victims Action Council, Charles Heller from Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, and Professor Nicholas Johnson from Fordham University School of Law. And we're just talking about the different capabilities of some of these weapons. Elliot Feynman, earlier you had made the point that you see no good reason for guns that shoot anything more than 5 to 10 bullets. Professor Johnson was just making the point that this weapon at issue in this lawsuit, the AR-15, is perhaps not exceptional in that regard. I want to go just come back to Nicholas Johnson quickly to just ask about Elliot Feynman's point. I mean, what, even if the gun is not exceptional as compared to other guns, what is the need for common citizens, for non-military people to have any kind of a gun that can shoot greater than, as Elliot Feynman said, 5 to 10 bullets?
I think when we push in this direction, just understand that what we're talking about is the rationale for limiting existing firearms that are in the inventory. And I believe, and I can't speak for everyone in this debate, but I believe the people who object to limitations on the AR-15 look at a variety of other firearms and say, well, if the logic for banning the AR-15 prevails, then it's a short step, in fact, a very easy step to a restriction on a variety of other firearms. And that's the reason that I gave the comparison to the common shotgun. So a standard buckshot load produces, with a single trigger pull, between 9 and 15 projectiles that spread down range. It's designed in a way that is similar to, when you look at the descriptions of why the AR-15 is objectionable, and then you look at descriptions of how the common shotgun loaded with buckshot operates, those objections that are raised about the AR-15 are actually more apt in the context of common shotgun, of which there are tens of millions. So the thing that I think people lose sight of is that this is a broader, longer debate, and I'm just trying as an observer to understand both sides of it, and I understand Mr. Feynman's point, but I think that people who are on the other side of the debate are thinking, well, the claims about the AR-15 are false, they are just technically inaccurate, and that there are a variety of other guns that people using the same logic might attack. And this has always been the character of the gun debate, that is, that it's this incrementalist exercise, and people will disagree about that. But I just wanted to sort of put it in perspective for people who are looking at it sort of from the outside.
This is Charles Heller. I'd like to respond to what Mr. Feynman said about semi-automatics. He's not aware of semi-automatics not being used in self-defense. I'm sorry that he's unaware of fact, but if you read the defensive gun uses that are published in the American Rifleman, you'll find that well more than half of them are done with semi-automatics. As far as the rifle being not defensive, where is it written in the Constitution that arms can only be defensive in their nature? You know, we're talking here about a basic individual right, no different than speech. It's absolutely no different than, read the Heller decision. I'm not related to him, but read the Heller decision. It is a basic, fundamental individual right, and we're talking here about a constitutional right. We're coming at it from the position of, well, why should they be allowed? Sir, government doesn't allow anything. Government isn't in a position to allow anything. The citizens are the ones that are in charge. We allow government to make some regulations. Government doesn't allow us our freedom. Freedom doesn't originate with government. You're born with it. Article 2, Section 2 of Arizona's Constitution and every single state constitution has a provision in it that says that the power is inherent in the people and that the purpose of government is to ensure the rights of the people.
Well, all of that is charming and the typical rhetoric that your side always puts out. The reality, of course, is that the issue here is the defensive use of guns. And all of these reports in the Rifleman, all of these reports by the fantastic John Lott, who deals in fantasy, about defensive gun uses, to me, are utterly flawed. And what reveals the flawed nature of them is that none of these people report to the police the incident. They all wind up letting the perpetrator that they claim to have defended themselves with their gun walk away. As law-abiding citizens, they let the people who supposedly they defended themselves against walk away free to attack other law-abiding citizens or maybe even come back a second time.
If I may, I'm a defense instructor, and that's all you legally can do, Mr. Feynman. And if you don't know that, then it's a lack of understanding on your part,
you
not
can't
a failure
report?
On the
are
part
you,
of the defense.
Are you saying you can't report that somebody attacked you and you had to use your gun to defend yourself? Is that what you're saying?
No, sir, I'm saying that you cannot legally use more force on a person once they stop attacking.
I'm not talking about force. I'm talking about reporting that somebody broke into your home or your store or accosted you on the street and you got them in a position where they were vulnerable and couldn't continue their attack, and you just let them walk away. You're saying you
can't
report that?
That's all you can legally.
So one of the things that happens here, I think that the debate here is about the survey results from the work of Gary Kleck, but also 14 other researchers, including researchers who were also expressed some doubt about Gary Kleck's original numbers determining defensive gun uses. But the methodologies that occur there are quite common. The one thing that I would add to this is that now in the Internet age, we have the benefit of actual reporting. We don't get much of this. In fact, we get virtually none of this from national reporting. But in local news stations all over the country, we find precisely the sort of reporting of defensive gun uses that we're describing here. And I recently had a couple of my students go through just a variety of YouTube reports, and they've got a link called Armed Self-Defense on YouTube that includes literally hundreds of episodes where people are actually reporting to the police. It ends up on the local news that someone broke into my house, I fired my gun. In a couple of these instances, people had security cameras. There's a very vivid incident of a woman in Detroit who actually uses a semi-automatic rifle to protect herself and her kids as three or four thugs were attempting to kick in her back door. They were armed, fires at them, they run off, they later are apprehended. And we're finding, in fact, now in, I believe, the police chief of Milwaukee and another statement from the police chief in Detroit indicating that they think that this is good, that people armed defend themselves against attacks that the police, just as a matter of physics, don't have an opportunity to respond to in time. So, you know, there's a dispute about the empirical data. But in terms of the anecdotal material, it's true that when there's one of these horrible events, the national media puts it on this continuous loop, and it looks like that's the only thing that's out there. But it is accurate to say that there are countervailing stories, and we see vividly the evidence of this in local and regional news.
Of course, the issue in this lawsuit is not self-defense, obviously. The issue in this lawsuit is the question of whether the manufacturer should ever bear responsibility or liability for how these weapons are used. And I just want to hear from all of you. I mean, I understand, I know that there's a statute out there that addresses this, but as a matter of policy, should gun manufacturers bear responsibility when something like this that happened in Sandy Hook occurs. Elliot Fineman, what's your position on that?
Well, I have a very strong position on it. And my position is that, of course, they should. Just like a manufacturer like General Motors or Toyota bears responsibility when one of their cars, you know, are defective, or there has to be some responsibility. The gun manufacturers have said very clearly and plainly that they have no responsibility or really no interest about who gets their gun once they make it. That their job is to just make it, and then however it gets out, you know, to the public, or law abidings or not law abidings, that's not their issue. But when you're making something that is or clearly dangerous and clearly can deliver, as it does, tremendous harm, pain, death, tragedy, et cetera, there is a responsibility to care about how your gun is sold. It would be like car manufacturers making cars and not caring how their dealers sold them. In other words, not requiring that their dealer, for example, require that anybody purchasing a car have proof of insurance or proof of, you know, a driver's license, so that there is a responsibility and it's a blatant disregard of safety. And I would contrast it to one other thing. In the fight to get sane drinking laws in terms of, you know, DUI laws passed, what the manufacturers did was they formed a group called the Century Council that was even more responsible for getting the DUI laws that we have than MAD. The Century Council said, yep, we make a great product, we want to sell a lot of them, but we don't want the product being used to or cause deaths of innocent people. A completely opposite view than the gun manufacturers have.
I'd like to respond to Mr. Fineman. First of all, once again, he doesn't know what he doesn't know. That exact what he talks about, a council of manufacturers, was exactly what happened in the early part of the 20th century when the Sporting Arms Manufacturing, SAMI, Sporting Arms Manufacturers Institute, was formed. And they all conformed to extremely exacting safety standards. Furthermore, they meticulously follow federal law as to how guns must be distributed, that they can only go through distributors, that the transfers be made only from, except at the end user, only be made through distributors and not through individuals and sold across state lines. They go through tremendous, rigorous, they go through audits at the risk of their business from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. They are exceedingly cautious about the way they do business. And the idea that they don't, if he doesn't know that, then he's not well informed. If he does know it and he isn't saying it, then he's doing something else.
Well, I happen to live in the 21st century. I'm not living in the early part of the 20th century, and things have completely changed. And to suggest or that we have controls about how guns are sold that are appropriate and rigorous belies the reality that 40% of the guns that are sold don't even go through a background check. They're bought on the internet. It also denies our freedom. You talk about your Second Amendment right freedom. I have a Second Amendment right freedom too, and it's to regulate guns.
Yes, I do. I'd like to respond. There was a time in this country when people voted on other people's rights. That was called Jim Crow. If you like Jim Crow, you'll love gun control.
Okay. I like gun safety, protecting the public safety, and your analogy is absurd, but I won't. Yeah. We don't have time to respond to that.
Well, we don't have time, but yeah, let me hear from Nicholas Johnson on this.
So I just wanted to sharpen the analogy. It is accurate to say that gun manufacturers go through a variety of regulatory steps based on the 1968 Gun Control Act. And the thing that I think Mr. Fineman is urging, if you took that argument and actually did extend it to other products, the argument would be that if someone in a state of intoxication drives a car and runs into someone and kills them, that both the liquor manufacturer and the automobile manufacturer should be responsible for the criminal act. That's the scenario that we're facing in the context of criminal use of firearms. And it turns out to be, in fact, that neither the no manufacturer in that context is liable for the criminal misuse of products that are both useful and dangerous. So useful and dangerous things include automobiles, they include alcohol, they include a variety of things where manufacturers are regulated, and if they behave negligently in the manufacture and in the distribution, meaning if they violate the law that governs the manufacture and distribution of those products, then they can be sued, and properly so. It's an extension beyond that, and what this suit does, and what the earlier suits before the current federal law was in place, what those suits tried to do was to say that criminal use of a lawful product should also result in the manufacturer being liable. And what we're really talking about here is just the fundamental disagreement in our society about how much risk and how much utility firearms present. And I mean, that is a fair disagreement. If I were in the position of Mr. Feinman, I probably would be making the arguments that he is making about risk and utility, because the risk of firearms has fallen particularly heavy on him, has fallen particularly heavy on the survivors of the victims, families of the victims in Newtown. And there are, on the other side of the ledger, though, other people who have defended themselves with firearms, who've got a longer history of a sort of distrust of local and state governments, and it's a complicated issue. It's sort of discouraging for me to hear folks angry at one another over this issue. We've got fair disagreement on the risk and utility of firearms. What the Prevention of Lawful Commerce and Firearms Act does, though, is to say that manufacturers are not going to be responsible for criminal use of their firearms if they have followed the law in terms of manufacturing and distribution.
Okay, we are pretty much near the end of our time. I do want to give each of you an opportunity to go around one more time and give me your closing thoughts on this issue. And I also invite you at that point to let our listeners know how they can find out more about the work that you're doing and follow up with you if they care to do that. So let me start, Elliot Feinman, with you. Your final thoughts today.
Well, first of all, to reach us, please just go to our website, www.gunvictimsaction.org, and you can find out all of the things we're doing, and then even join in and participate in a number of things we're doing. The reality here, there are two realities here that really drive a lot of this situation. One is the position of the other side that any sane gun law is an attack on their freedoms and is going to lead to confiscation. And if you hold that position, as they do, as I'm sure Mr. Heller does, that means you can't have any gun laws, because any gun law leads to confiscation, which, of course, one of the things that's so striking is that the other side doesn't realize that the government doesn't have to know who has a single gun. They're opposed to registration and licensing on the basis of, well, if the government knows who has a gun, they'll take them away. The government doesn't have to know who has a single gun to take them all away. But the government has never taken all the guns away. The only people who talks about taking guns away, of course, are the pro-gunners, the NRA gun lobby, etc. The other point here is guns do not offer self-protection. Carrying a gun does not offer you self-protection. The element of surprise always defeats the gun carrier. If guns offered protection, carrying them, no police officers would get killed. President Reagan wouldn't have gotten shot. The reality is that it doesn't, and we're doing a study now that will be coming out in the spring that will definitively show that carrying a gun, either concealed in public, either concealed or openly, provides no self-defense. So we're stuck with fantasies, you know, of it was just interesting, just 2 weeks ago, there was a group in Texas, the Truth About Guns, that recreated the Charlie Hebdo attack. And they had people, you know, armed with guns, you know, being the people in Charlie Hebdo that would be attacked. And then when they were attacked, not one single person survived. Not one. The only one, actually, there was one woman who survived the attack in this simulation, and it was because she ran away. Everyone else who tried to defend themselves or tried to intervene were killed. I mean, in this simulation. There have been other simulations to show, you know, the paucity of this idea that guns provide self-defense. They're offensive weapons, and they certainly can be used and should be used for people to hunt and for marksmanship and things like that, but we don't need people walking around carrying guns.
Thanks a lot, Elliot Feynman. Charles Heller, former executive director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, let's hear your final thoughts.
I'm certified by my state to teach people to carry guns because the state of Arizona knows the value of walking around with one. And all the other states currently have methods of making sure that people have the proper training so that they can be safe and effective walking around with guns. And I don't carry one. I carry two. This is so much for his theory. I've had four DGUs, defensive gun uses, in my life. Thankfully, I've never ended up having to pull the trigger. As far as getting in touch with us, you can reach us through our website, JPFO, that's Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, .org. If you want to reach me, Charles Heller, at JPFO.org. And in closing, I'd like to say, you can never, ever achieve anything in society by punishing the innocent for the acts of the guilty. And as far as not wanting gun laws, of course there's moral gun laws. There's five of them, and rarely can anyone ever name the five moral gun laws. One, you're responsible for every shot you fire. Two, if you're under 18, your rights come through your parents. Three, if you criminally misuse a gun, the court can sever your rights. Four, if you are declared a danger to yourself, a court can sever your rights. And five, anyone who for any reason attempts to take any gun from you under any but the first four circumstances should immediately be arrested, heavily fined, imprisoned, and banned from government service.
Thanks a lot. And Nicholas Johnson, you get the last word today.
Okay. Well, I'll just give a pitch to some of the work that I've done in the past. The question about supply controls and incremental bans and the sort of political debate between basically the left and the right on this issue, I wrote about several years ago in an article in the Wake Forest Law Review called Testing the Question of Supply Controls. And what I show there is that given the number of guns that we start with, the issue of supply controls and the viability of supply controls is something that people, regardless of what they think about the utility of firearms, should be quite skeptical about just in terms of its potential consequences. So I'll pitch that, and people can get a citation to it on my website at the Fordham Law School webpage. The other thing, again, that I'll emphasize is that there is a serious debate about the deterrent impact of armed citizens. There have been a variety of studies. Richard Wright did a couple of books several years ago dealing with this issue. I've got citations to that on my webpage. Also, I would urge people to look just at sort of, unfortunately here, the anecdotal evidence seems to be more powerful than lots of the sort of careful empirical work. Go to Armed Self-Defense or the Armed Self-Defense channel on YouTube, and what you will see are a variety of public reports that defy the common national reporting suggesting that there are only costs associated with firearms. And of course, people have to make up their own minds about the balance, but we're not doing ourselves a favor by suggesting that firearms only present risks and only have costs. They also have benefits. People have to make up their own minds about how to balance that for their own situations.
Well, thanks to all of you for sharing your thoughts and insights on this topic. I really appreciate it. Our guests today have been Elliot Feynman, President and CEO of the National Gun Victims Action Council, Charles Heller, a radio host and the former executive director, now communications director for Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, and Nicholas Johnson, professor of law at Fordham University School of Law and author of the textbook Second Amendment Cases and Materials, published by Aspen Press in 2012. That does it for today's episode. Hope you'll join us next time for another episode of Lawyer to Lawyer. Remember, when you want legal, think Lawyer to Lawyer. Thanks for listening.